Well, my guest at the big table is a Chicago poet, writer, and now television producer. So excited. Fatima Oscar is one of the women behind the Chicago web series Brown Girls, which was just picked up by HBO. It's a great series that follows two women of color, created by two women of color. Fatima is a well-known name in the Chicago poetry scene. She was awarded a 2017 fellowship with the Poetry Foundation, Lilly Fellow. She's also been a teaching artist at the Young Chicago Authors and has a new collection of poetry called If They Come For Us, which will be out soon, Random House. Her work is informed by issues of identity and language and pushing back against the stereotypes and lazy narratives that we use in the world around us. I mean, who better to understand the world than a Pakistani, Kashmiri, Muslim, American, queer woman? Did I mention Chicagoan in there? Fatima is currently developing the Emmy-nominated Brown Girls for HBO, the web series that our buddy Sonia Denise starred in. We had her back on the show when it debuted. Fatima Oscar is one of the best poets working in Chicago today, and she is my guest at the big table. Fatima, thanks for being here. Good to see you.
Yeah, it's good to see you. Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's talk Brown Girls. This is really exciting. When we saw the news come out, we're like, yes, because I feel like, you know, we were early on with Sonia. We were excited about it. It was a great web series. Talk about how this came about. I mean, because it was a web series, and it was Elle Magazine and other places that put it up on the site. But how does it get from that to HBO?
Yeah, I mean, so when I first wrote the web series, it really was written for my community. I didn't think anybody would watch it beyond my friends. Like, I was kind of envisioning a show that my friends would sit around and laugh to. And then Sam Bailey, who is my co-creator and director, came on board to direct it. And Sam had made other web series in Chicago called You're So Talented.
Right.
But I was really, really excited to be working with her. And again, it was very indie, everything we did. Our budget was $20,000. We were kind of really, really bootstrapping everything there. And I really, you know, there was no way in my wildest dreams that I think that we would be where we are right now. But kind of as soon as we dropped the trailer, we noticed this buzz around it. And when we dropped the trailer, it was through like a lot of our friends, like their local media outlets.
Right.
Like one of the first people to write about us was a blog called Black Nerd Problems, which is run by poets. And so they you know, flagged it up, and then it kind of got picked up to bigger places like Elle and Time and people who were writing about us. And then we got a lot of interest in it and went out and pitched it, and HBO was really, really excited about it. And so it kind of happened very, very quickly. Like, this all happened within, you know, a year and some change. And so that to be the timeline of this production is pretty astounding.
Well, I mean, you live such an artistic life, because you're a poet, you're an educator, you're a performer, you're also a screenwriter. But in this case, I mean, you're creating a web series. This has to be something that is taking over a lot more of your time.
Yeah.
As you become, you know, talk about that experience, the idea of doing something as just one other project, and then that project takes off and gets to this level and it almost defines you.
Yeah, I mean, so I am, you know, I'm a poet, and that's what I do. That's kind of where I really cut my teeth and where my craft skills really lie. And so there is this really interesting thing to have tried, like, Brown Girls was my first attempt at screenwriting. It was my first time trying to do anything for screen. And so to see Brown Girls kind of skyrocketing and to be working on poetry for so long and to feel that these two vastly different worlds kind of happening at the same time has been really, really interesting. And, you know, as Brown Girls, I've been working on Brown Girls. I've also been working on my poetry book. And some of these poems I've had for years, you know, and it's like really about arranging the words on every single poem and really thinking about every single line and how you do that. And screenwriting kind of flies a little bit faster because it's so much about dialogue, and there's kind of a quickness that comes with.
Oh, yeah. They're different disciplines, right?
Totally. Yeah. Yeah.
Does it change? I mean, is it hard for you to do that?
I don't think so. I think that I have to be in a certain mindset to write either one, right? When I'm writing screenwriting, I can do it whenever. So I can do it like in a cafe, and I can do it when there's a lot of noise around me, and it's okay because of how noisy it is, right? You have so many characters who are living inside you, so many things that are happening. But with poetry, I really need that space to be quiet, and I need to be in a place where I can be reflective. And if I'm not, then like I can't really write poetry. It's hard for me. And so that's kind of the biggest difference, is the mentality it takes to either be in, you know, either one. But they're really beneficial in the sense of, if when I'm burnt out on poetry or when I feel like I've hit a wall, I can like delve into screenwriting and vice versa. Yeah.
Right. Brown Girls, let's go back over it. I mean, it stars two women who of color, uh-huh, who are in Chicago. It's great. And the great thing about it is it's a comedy, and it follows their lives, but it's not necessarily about their what color they are, mm-hmm. or their identity. I mean, it plays a role in it, but there's something great about it's refreshing in the way that this is a show that is the characters facing forward who are living their lives in a 20-something Chicago. And that's what I loved about it. It's really what I loved about it.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it was really important to just show these characters as human, right? And so when I think about my identity and how it functions day to day, a lot of times it's in the background. It's like the vision that I see a lot of things through, but it's not necessary. I'm not always talking about my identity 24/7. Right, right. And so there's a way that these girls just are girls. They're just girls who can't get their relationships right, right? Like, they're girls who, like, mess up things with their family all the time, and where their families are, like, annoyed at them for not being more, like, financially responsible, right? Like, there's ways that I think that these are very real struggles that almost anybody who has been in their early 20s has felt, right? That feeling of being like, cool, I'm now no longer in school, where everything was measured by, like, what is considered successful. It's really easy to know it's successful if you got an A, right? When you're in the real world, it's not easy to know when things are successful when you're balancing all of these different life decisions. And so that's really where the show lays its heart. And I think specifically thinking about Chicago, thinking about the Chicago artistic community, thinking about the Chicago artistic community of color, and thinking about the ways that these communities are so unique, right? Like, there is nothing like Chicago art, and it's so beautiful to be a part of, but it is very much a thing that is so special and that I really wanted to show in the series. And so to me, a lot of, like, all of these characters came from intersectional backgrounds, but they did because that's just who they are and how they live, and the kind of struggles that they face are everyday struggles.
Why do you think it is? Because there's hundreds of articles that are written about brown girls, and almost all of them say this is the future, finally a fresh or unique take on women of color. Mm-hmm. And Hollywood up to this point, or people who've been in media, they've glossed over it, or they've created, very large kind of swath generalities or stereotypes. I mean, is it that obvious that Hollywood is doing that and you guys aren't?
I mean, I think so. it's really interesting. Like Sam, like you said, this Sam Bailey and I are both women of color. And when you put two women of color in charge of a story that is about women of color, then it's told in a certain way, right? And our cinematographer was a queer woman, right? And so we had all of this way in which we were literally changing the gaze of the show, right? Like, when you have a cinematographer that is a queer woman shooting a story about queerness and about womanhood and about all of these different things, like, the camera gaze is different. And so there was really a way that I think by empowering all of these people of marginalized identities to really take a step forward and to have control in the artistic production of this series, we had a different series than what is typical of Hollywood, right?
Well, I have so many questions. Let's take a quick break, but I have so many questions about developing and what it means to develop from a web series to something like HBO, which has a lot of there's a track record in doing that. Mm-hmm. Issa Rae and others who've done tremendous work. High Maintenance is one of the HBO web series. Fatima Oskar's in studio with me. She's a Chicago poet, writer, television mogul. She's the creator of Brown Girls, co-creator and writer of Brown Girls, a web series that was picked up by HBO. We'll take a quick break, come back, talk more with Fatima here at the Big Table. It's Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman in studio tonight. The Big Table, Fatima Oskar. She is a poet, writer, educator, television producer. Her web series, Brown Girls, was picked up by HBO. Before we move on to your world of poetry, which I have a lot of questions about, what does it mean to be picked up, developed by HBO? How does that work? I mean, did they just say, yes, we want that. That's everything about it. Do it again. Or do you have to start from scratch?
Yeah, I mean, HBO is a really amazing network in that, as you mentioned, they have picked up things from the web and made them into series. And what HBO does is they really believe in people's voices. So when they see something and they really like that voice, that's where HBO really thrives. And they're an amazing network to work with. But development is basically, you and your team and the execs kind of talking about story and fleshing out story and thinking about how to take something that was made for a web format and elongate it and create it so that it has legs that can sustain itself for a long time. And it's a really different process. You know, I think about web series as thinking about moments, right? Like, a web series is a lot like a poem in that you're kind of hyper-focused on these moments that these characters are living. And a more standard network show is really focused on story and
beginning,
narrative,
middle, end, the whole thing, right?
Yeah, and structure and things like that. So it's a really different world that you're kind of working in.
Do they pair you up with someone like a television producer, showrunner, who's like, oh, this is how it is?
Yeah, I mean, I think the process is different for each for each creator. We have a showrunner named Amy Aniobi, who's amazing. So that's been really, really great. And our we have two producers on it, 3Arts Entertainment and MXN. And they're amazing. And so we work a lot with 3Arts and MXN in terms of development, and then also with HBO.
There you go.
Yeah.
There you go. Look at you, Hollywood. I love it. Throwing around 3Arts Entertainment. Like it's no big deal. Fatima, let's talk about your poetry, because, you know, in Chicago, a lot of people in the arts community know you as a poet, and you've performed all over town, and you've been a teaching author at Young Chicago Authors, and you've done so much. Let's talk about that. How did you get into poetry? Because you're a performer as well. You've done theater.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about poetry that drew you in?
Yeah, I mean, to me, so in high school, I used to do theater a lot, and I started writing poetry more seriously when I was in college. Like, I would write like little poems to like people I had crushes on, and in middle school. But then when I was in college, I really saw the way that spoken word was being used in a blending of performance and poetry. And what really inspired me about poetry was that people were just telling their authentic stories, right? And I think that is so hard to do when you are that age. It is really hard to be like, this is who I am, and these are all the things I believe. And the kind of confidence I saw in that was so compelling to me, and was such a thing that drew me in. And to me, poetry has kind of always been a place where I can explain myself, my truest self, very honestly and very vulnerably. And so sometimes, like, there are poems I'll write that even surprise me, that I'm like, oh, this is a truth about myself I didn't know, and it's kind of a way to excavate yourself and to really understand who you are. And I think that's really important to me.
It is an interesting art form, because not unlike theater is collaborative in the way that a director or a playwright is going to do exactly what you just said, use their voice, and actors will act it out. Music, and you think of rap music or any others, there's collaboration with the music and the beats. But there's something about poetry, especially the poetry that's evolved in 2017, think of Louder Than the Bomb and other places that are doing spoken word poetry, where you write it down, you have a microphone, maybe not, you're in the back of a cafe, and you're able to perform a piece. Do you like that? Do you like the collaboration with yourself, this idea that it's you and you alone up there working?
Yeah, I mean, I think that poetry, like, as you're saying, TV and theater, it takes so many people to make that stuff happen. Like, sometimes I just see TV shows and I'm like, that's a miracle it happened, because it just takes so many people to raise that, but for poetry, to me, poetry is a really community-oriented practice, and it is a really collaborative practice, because how I was kind of brought up in poetry was by these spaces where you would share your work, right? And so you would share your work either on a stage, or you would share in a circle, and then people would give you feedback. And it was kind of this thing where, and we would slam together, and it would be a lot of people giving you edits, or it would be people talking to you about how you performed. And so there's kind of a way that I think people think of poetry as like you sitting by your desk by yourself, which I think an element of it is, right? And then there's also a moment of you sharing with the community, and that poetry kind of being a conversation that happens. And so to me, poetry still has these elements of collaboration that I think are so important to the work. And we even see it with, like, in 2017, I think poetry has such a importance in this world, especially in this like political world. And whenever something happens, like, some of the things that are most immediate to go viral are like tweets and poems, right? And like, what is a tweet but a small poem, and then a poem that goes viral where people are I'm connected to this, and I think that kind of virality to me speaks of a need for it. It's like, it's so obvious and evident to me that poetry is collaborative and it's needed, and it's because people are clinging to it in moments of like deep urgency, and when they feel like they don't have anything else.
Poetry is so interesting when it comes to just the marketing of it, and marketing might not be at the awareness of it, where at one point that was the way that writers communicated.
Yeah.
Then it went to a point where it almost became this elitist form, right, where people only studied it in school and said, oh, it's time for this boring half hour of poetry. And watching it swing back, and I think about Chicago being the epicenter of this with slam poetry and even what was happening I just had the screenwriter of Love Jones that was on the show not too long ago, and that was all about a certain type of spoken word. Mm-hmm. And now you see what's happening to young Chicago authors, the Harold Washington Libraries, how that leading into what poetry becomes music, and, right. and all the people who are leading pop culture at this point. It's amazing to watch the arc of this. Where do you think it is in 2017? Is it more in the realm of the spoken word where people are looking at it as it's back to sort of the cool?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's always been that, because that's what spoken word, you know, I have such strong roots in that. But I do think that there is a way that poetry has, I've noticed that there's a different conversation around poetry right now than there was even a few years ago. And it does seem very vital to me. And I think that there is elements, like in Chicago, you know, it's amazing when you have like teams of For Louder Than a Bomb walking around like they're in a sports team, right?
Yeah,
like
right.
that's so
hundreds
so...
of kids from high school that get in a tournament,
right?
Louder Than a Bomb, we've talked about it on the show, but if you don't know what that is, it's a tournament citywide that these kids come together and they do poetry competition.
Yeah, and then at, you know, every single Tuesday at Young Chicago Authors, there's a free open mic, and that room is always packed, and it's all of these people who want to share their poems or want to just listen to each other, and so the kind of magic of like communication is so apparent to me, and you see it when a poem goes viral online too, and people are trying to connect to that, you know. And then Chicago is such a artistically rich city. It's such a rich city for words and for music and for poetry. But, you know, there's like Young Chicago Authors, there's the Poetry Foundation, there's all of these spaces that offer free programming that you can come to, that you can, you know, watch these come and like listen to a reading of really, really amazing, talented poets kind of give that to you.
The Poetry Foundation, your Lilly Fellow, mm-hmm. the fellowship, the 2017 fellowship. Talk about that, because that kind of plays into the idea. The Poetry Foundation is an esteemed organization. It's been known worldwide as one of it's the bearer of poetry. Talk about the contrast or the collaboration between the new and the old that happens at the Poetry Foundation.
Yeah, I mean, I love the Poetry Foundation for this, because I think that they are such arbiters of culture, and it's so amazing to see them being like, all of these things are considered poetry, and we put a platform for all of this. And so, you know, thinking about like my work and thinking about just even my knowledge of Don, you know, who's the editor, Don was the person who like brought in the Breakbeat issue for Poetry Magazine, right? And so had basically opened the doors of Poetry Magazine to all of these folks who are spoken word poets, who come from backgrounds of hip hop and come from a melding of like musicality and poetry, and was like, this is poetry and this is really, really important and you all should like read this, you know? And so I really love that they are so insistent on that, and then that happens. And it's beautiful too, because when we won the Ruth Lilly Fellowship, Don put out a statement about the five fellows who won. And in the statement said stuff around how urgent and important people's poems are in daily life and in community, right? And was saying like that it was really that a lot of the fellows were doing work in community and that their poems had like significance and meaning. And a lot of them came from like a few of them came from spoken word backgrounds or came from non-traditional academic backgrounds. And I think that that's amazing, yeah. You know?
Fatima Osgur is in studio, Chicago poet, writer, television producer. Brown Girls just picked up for HBO. We'll do this. We'll take a break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. We'll come back with Fatima and do second half of The Big Table. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman in studio tonight. The Big Table, Fatima Osgur. She is a poet, writer, television creator, producer, Brown Girls, the web series now picked up by HBO in development. We're talking about not only her career in poetry, but also Brown Girls. She's got If They Come For Us, the collection of poetry, which will be out soon, Random House. A lot of your work, and we kind of talked about this right at the beginning, was, you know, it's not necessarily everything's about identity. Mm-hmm. But it is, there's a lot of your works around language, and I really like it because you've had such a diverse upbringing with language. Mm-hmm. Let's just start there. In your household, different language was spoken, different language that you used to respond. Mm-hmm. Talk about the role of language when you're creating and writing and performing your poetry.
Yeah, I mean, language is always so interesting to me. I think especially coming, so my family spoke Urdu in the house growing up, and I would respond in English. That's like a very, I feel like it's a very typical like first generation thing to respond in English. And to the point where now I get really, I like can't speak Urdu because I get really self-conscious about it, but I can understand it whenever I hear it. But I think that language is so interesting, especially coming from an immigrant family, because of the way that language is so permeable, right? Like my family, you know, wouldn't understand, like was learning English in America, but would like sing along to rap songs that were on the radio because they were on the radio and didn't know what the words meant, right? And so there was always this like kind of funny thing where my sisters would make fun of my aunts and uncles for doing that because they were singing, like they would sing along a lot to Project Chick, that song, and it's such a nasty song, like the lyrics when you really take apart those words. But it was such an endearing thing to see like my family trying to learn English through these different cultural mechanisms. And so I think that language is so interesting because of its permeability, but also because of its deep histories, right? Like when you start to take apart language and you start to think about individual words and you really learn the origin of those words, there's all of these worlds that open to you. And so I kind of feel like you could be in the pursuit of knowledge around language for your whole life.
Yeah, and people are. Yeah.
Yeah, and like not know anything, you know, like there's a way.
We're in such a weird spot too in 2017 where language is weaponized.
Yeah.
And we see this in, I love that you said that Twitter is kind of like little poems.
Yeah.
Because then there are a lot of poets right now. Right? And a lot of people using language in a way that they do have, there is meaning behind
right,
it. And
right.
They're using different words and choices and wanting to make meaning out of different words and, mm-hmm. and the language they're using. I mean, there is something to be said about the power of the written word and how it's used and how it's interpreted.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that, yeah, I mean, I was thinking about this. There's this form of poetry called Alandai, which is in Afghanistan. And it's like kind of these little couplets that are sung in secret from woman to woman. And they're anonymous. They become part of the fabric of this underground web of women who share them. And tweets are kind of like that too. We were just talking about this, where it's like someone tweets something and you remember the content of the tweet and you don't always remember who tweeted it, but they kind of become part of this like fabric of constant chatter that is around you and these kind of constant little sayings or wisdoms or reactions to the world. And I really love that. You know, I think that there's a real beauty in being able to have people so, interested in like their in language and getting that out. And I think it's wonderful.
As a poet, you also work around the concept of identity.
Mm-hmm.
And those two things are connected. And you see language, especially what we're talking about on Twitter and in 2017, language being weaponized about identity.
Mm-hmm.
The word Muslim means something. It seems like it means something different than it did even 2-3 years ago.
Right.
How do you see those two things intertwining, this idea of language and identity? Because in your case, and as I said in the intro, you're who better equipped because of you identify in so many different ways, Pakistani, Muslim, American,
right.
Queer, woman, Chicago. I mean, there's a lot of different ways to see the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that with language and identity, language is so important because it allows you to identify all the ways that you are by yourself and not have people's ideas of identities imposed upon you, right? And so that to me is always a fight in language and in poetry that is so important to me, is being like, it's not like you know, you might hear the word Muslim and think of one thing, and I might be a different Muslim than you might think of, and a different Muslim to another Muslim, right? Because for how many people who are Muslim there are all those ways of being Muslim, right? And I think that
there's a lot of different ways to be Muslim.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of stuff that kind of gets forgotten. And when you see, you know, especially with the current like presidential administration, the way that some of these like words become coded, and you're like, oh, like that is meant to be, that is a racialized thing people are saying, but they're coding it, right? That's like the history of so much of rhetoric in American politics, right? So when you're going back to the war on drugs, or when people are talking about the war on terror, like these are coded things, but you know who people people who say that consider to be worthy of being American or being, you know.
I saw a tweet, and again, I can't tell you who tweeted it.
Yeah.
But it was so telling, and said that we're talking about language and identity, but we're coding words in 2017. Ban, travel ban. Ban is Muslim. Wall, Latino.
Mm-hmm.
And then they say Chicago, black. Mm-hmm. That's the words that are being used to replace those words. Mm-hmm. And this person on Twitter saying that's just the way to be publicly racist.
Right.
But you see how language and identity are intertwined, but it's also interesting to see how we code things.
Yeah, and I think it's important for us to, when we see that, to call it out, right? To be like, wait, this is actually racially coded language, but then also to know that we have those same tools to fight back, right? Like, language is very, very powerful, and we, as artists, as creators, as poets, as whoever we are, as journalists, we can say, like, there is power in the language that we speak, and we choose to use our language to correct some of this, the racism or the vile, like, you know, hate speech that we see that's so prevalent in the media.
Yeah. I loved your poem, and I want to ask a question too, just about a lot of the way you're able to use video and use film, mm-hmm. and other places to express your words, to almost make it a music video for your poem, which mm-hmm. I love. But the one that was, but you're not going to find your name in a keychain, mm-hmm. or on a keychain, yeah. in a store, and how American uses your name and moves it around. And there's something really eloquent in the idea that, yeah, well, there is this idea that we're sometimes Americans across spectrum, even when they feel like they're in good intentions, they use it how they want to use it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think that there's, you know, being a person of color in America, being all of these different identity traits, I've learned very early on when someone is saying something as, like, as a mean thing, or versus when someone is saying it just out of genuine curiosity, yeah, right? So, like, the question, like, where are you from, doesn't bother me without, like, a tonal problem, right? When people... I've also heard that question in a really threatening way, and I know what, you know, I know the difference between that.
So,
and
tone plays a big role,
right? But I do think that even when some of these questions are well intentioned, or even, like, you know, there's a loneliness that happens when people can't pronounce your name. There's a loneliness when your name is always mispronounced, when people don't know where you're from and they assume that you're from somewhere else, right? Like, there's these kind of ways that some of those questions hint to a deep truth about who we consider American and who we don't. As an American who you know, was born here and has grown up here, that kind of alienation and loneliness is very palpable. And I think that there's a way that, you know, when I think about why I write poetry, to one of your earlier questions, a lot of it really comes from that feeling of being like, I can be in charge of this language, and I can, you know, I can create a space in this lexicon where I get to be my full self and I get to advocate for people who are like me.
I wonder, I just, you know, I'm curious just about your feelings, your emotions around what's happening in this country when it comes to a travel ban and the way that the current administration is using the word Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as an artist, as a poet, but also as an American.
Yeah, I mean, I was in seventh grade when September 11th happened, and I always knew, you know, as just a racialized person, that I was different and that there was ways that people would treat me differently and you know, kind of speak to me sometimes in moments that would feel bad. But when September 11th happened, it was really palpable. And there was a way that the kind of Islamophobia that was there, especially when, you know, as a seventh grader, I was, like, learning, you know, that's like when you get BO, like, you're, like, trying to be like a kid and you have all of this other weight that's added, yeah. to it. And I remember just having such a deep shame. There was such a shame attached suddenly to being Muslim and to being my skin color and walking around. And, you know, I see that happening again now. And I think that, you know, when you see now as an adult, there's a way that I can just be like, you know, I know that that's not a reflection of me or my family or my people. And I know that stuff is born out of ignorance. But when I work with high school kids, I see how it really damages them, you know, and I see the ways that people say small microaggressive things to them. And that really takes a toll on them. And it makes me really sad. I think that America has a terrible history with racism, right? Like, this country was built mm-hmm. on Native genocide and on slavery. And yet we don't talk about that, and when people
we
aren't
want to confront it,
yeah, yeah, and people aren't, oh, there's no public memorials to that, there's no real way of where people are held accountable to that that history. And then therefore, when you kind of see the way that this administration is attacking all of these different groups, right, and like perpetuating this racism in all of these different ways, it's really disheartening. And I would hope that, you know, Americans could counter that, but also, you know, history has shown us that Americans have not, you know? And so I think it takes a lot of work on all of our behalf to counter those wrongs.
Fatima Asghar is in studio with me. She's a Chicago poet, writer, the woman who is the co-creator and writer of Brown Girls, which was just picked up for HBO in development. You know, another part of your life, which is extremely uplifting. I mean, it's just that you do work with a lot of kids.
Mm-hmm.
And you work in Chicago, where there are so many great young poets and young people coming through, and yourself included. There has just been a renaissance. Mm-hmm. Pete and I talk about this all the time, that we'll have people on and it'll be an artist or a rapper, or someone comes in and says, well, I got my start doing spoken word.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I got now, and Chance the Rapper's up on stage at the Grammys. I mean, there's something to be said about that all happens here in Chicago. That happens with you. That happens with everything that's happening in the, like you said, the Tuesday night open mics and the places where these kids are getting to express themselves. The Daily Show had a huge piece on young Chicago authors last week.
Yeah.
How does it make you feel that this is happening, and is it happening? I guess that's the question. That does it feel like a renaissance, that there's something special happening in Chicago?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it makes me really proud. And the thing is, like, I'm not from Chicago, but I consider Chicago my home and I've lived here for a while. But there's a way that there's such a fierce pride I feel when I see that. And like, having worked with so many young people in Chicago and just seeing all of these stories, and really I love my students. You know, I go to bat for my students, and I think about the way that I get to see them grow up into the artists they are. And it's just such a beautiful, enriching thing. And I really do think there's a renaissance happening. Like, there's a way that, you know, Chicago is so inspiring. Like, you can walk down the street and go to galleries and be like, these are beautiful. And like, that's not, you know, you don't have to live downtown for that. There's galleries in all of these, in so many.
Do you think that's it? I guess my question is just why. I always wonder what's in the sauce. What's the recipe that these kids are? Well, you see Louder Than a Bomb and you're like, what?
I mean,
how are these kids so good?
Yeah, I think Chicago has a deeply, you know, blue collar work ethic in all that it does. Right, Chicago people, any. They just hustle. And I think that same thing is applied to art, right? I think folks hustle, and I think folks they expand their voice, they expand their what they're doing. And to me, that's so authentic, right? Because people, you're not coming here to like make it in whatever capacity. You're coming here because you want to work, and right. You're coming here because you want to be part of this community. And so to me, that's really what distinguishes Chicago, and that's why it feels like a renaissance right now.
Well, it also, and I feel like you do this with your work, and it's plain as day when I see it and hear it and read it. But the kids are able to, and this is your teachings and others that are in the community, draw their experiences, their personal experiences, their feelings, everything that's happening to them out, and be able to express it artistically.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's happening everywhere in the way that these are real stories. And I think that has to do with the teachers and the people who are saying, go deep in, find the story, that find your voice, and be able to express it.
Yeah. And that's lineage too. Like, that's Gwendolyn Brooks, you know, that's like, that's real Chicago lineage. That's like Studs Terkel. Like, there is a way that I think so many people who've come out of Chicago really have believed in using yourself as the source material, and using your communities and looking around you and uplifting kind of the everyday into poetry. And so to me, that's such a, it feels like such a Chicago thing. And I'm so glad that, you know, that's like YCA's teaching pedagogy, and I love it, because I think that that's really true. I mean, I think once you kind of realize that you are a storyteller and your stories are worth talking about, like, you're unstoppable, right? And so I think that that's what I see a lot in the way that we teach students, and that, you know, a lot of young creatives coming out of Chicago, even who don't come through YCA, I see with that same mentality and logic, and I think that's a really Chicago thing.
Fatima, the book's coming out soon.
Yes.
And then when should we expect to see Brown Girls on the HBO screen?
So I don't have an answer for
Three
Brown
weeks?
Girls. Brown Girls, we're still early in development.
Will you shoot it in Chicago?
I'm hoping, you know, we're still, again, early in development, so that's...
Come on, you got to put your foot down.
I know. That's something I'm definitely going to advocate for.
You got to get hard to work with right now, early in your career, right?
You're like, this is what I will not compromise on. No, I mean, I do think that the show is so integral. It is a Chicago show, and it would make me so happy to be able to film here and to film in the ways that we want, you know, and to show Chicago how we want to show it. And so that's something that I think if we get to that stage, I'm going to be really, really excited about.
Well, the web series Brown Girls, you can find it online. It's still out there from when it ran last year. It was picked up by HBO. We'll see it soon on the screen. Fatima Asghar, poet, writer, television producer. The book If They Come For Us will be out on Random House soon. Also the Ruth Lilly Fellow at the Chicago Poetry Foundation. Fatima, thanks so much for joining us and being at the big table tonight.
Yeah, thank you for having me.